You are listening to the WGXC Afternoon Show with Sarah and Melinda and Noah, and we have got Candace Taylor on the line. Candace, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, great. Well, we're really excited to have you on the air with us because we are super interested in the work that you're doing. Candace is the author of Counterculture, which is a multimedia project which profiled waitresses aged 50 and older who've been working in neighborhood diners across the United States. According to Taylor's website, called TaylorMade, Capturing Culture One Story at a Time, the Waitress Project features women who have been dishing out everything from eggs to insults for up to 60 years. They are among the healthiest, most vibrant, hardest-working women in the U.S. They have raced to our tables, quarreled with the cooks, and brought humor and culture to the American roadside dining experience. Despite the social stigma of being just a waitress, this multimedia project tells the stories of women who enjoy what they do. Candace, we heard about this project in the night, and we also heard about some of the work that you're involved in now around beauty shops, and we thought it would be really fun to hear you talk in your own words about your work with the Waitress Project and also what you're doing now. Okay. So welcome to WGXC.
Well, thank you. And yeah, I started the beauty shop project more recently, but I've been working on them simultaneously. Both Counterculture and the Beauty Shop Project have been in my life for many years. Counterculture, The American Coffee Shop Waitress, which is a book that was published by Cornell University Press, was released a couple of years ago, and that's been a labor of love for about 10 years. And I started the project because I was in graduate school at the time, and I was in my early 30s, and I just wanted to know how these women who were 50, 60, and 70 years old did this job, you know, how they felt about their jobs. I had been working in a sushi restaurant, and I was overwhelmed and tired by the job, but I did enjoy it. And very little had been written about the subculture of women, so I focused on women who were all 50 and older and who were working in diners. And it was a great experience. I imagine that these women would be tired and feel maybe a little bitter, a little underappreciated, and that's not what I found. I found over 90% of the women I interviewed said they absolutely loved what they did. They wouldn't do anything else, and they were it was an amazing process of discovery for me to see how these women were no longer something that you would feel sorry for, but were actually feeling empowered by their choice to continue waitressing well after they were past retirement age.
And what made you choose diners? Is there some correlation between diners and women working past their 50s or for more than for an extended period of time in diners as opposed to other types of restaurants?
Yes. I chose diners because I was, like I said, working in a sushi restaurant, and I thought, well, even if, you know, my shifts were 4 to 6 hours, and I know the average diner waitress works about 8 to 10 hour shifts, and also their meals are a lot less expensive. So if my average table was spending about $100, I knew that, you know, average waitress in a diner, she was getting maybe $20 if she was lucky as her, you know, as the bill. So I was very curious, you know, how they handled the rush, how they handled so many tables. I would have between maybe an average of four to six or seven tables. Some of the waitresses featured in Counterculture were working 12 to 15 tables at a time, and again, they were, you know, 30, 40 years older than me. So I was very interested how they handled the job. I also wanted to focus on diners because there's a great, you know, regular clientele that they have that, you know, in finer dining restaurants, you don't get that. So even if you do get regulars, it's not that, you know, Bob comes in every day at 9 o'clock and I've seen him for the last 30 years and he's never changed his order. You know, I mean, I heard stories like that, so I thought this was, you know, a basic staple in so many communities in America. And so I really wanted to capture the essence of what was happening in the American diner, how these women were, you know, kind of icons of American culture. And so, yeah, it was very specifically geared towards that.
I thought it was interesting just listening to some of the women that you spoke to, that some of them said that they were making a pretty good living and a particularly good living for a woman to make that kind of money back in the 1960s or 70s when they first started working in the diners. Were you surprised by that at all?
I was. I mean, I wasn't that shocked because I had been waitressing and I stayed, even after I got my master's degree, I continued waitressing for another maybe 4 or 5 years because it was a way to make a full-time wage without working part-time for me. So I knew the money that could be made if you were a good waitress, although I had no idea. I mean, these women largely, again, were from a different generation than me, and over 60%, between 60 and 70% had been divorced. And they were raised in a time when, you know, they had families, the man took care of them and their kids, and, you know, all of a sudden they're divorced and they have to take care of kids and they need a job and they have no college degree or even work experience. So a lot of them fell into waitressing by default because they didn't feel like they had any other choice. But the ones who went into, you know, being a secretary or working in a department store found they made so much more money waitressing that it just didn't make sense to do anything else given what opportunities were available to them. So, yeah, well, my mom, for instance, you know, she was making between $800 and $900 a week in the 70s and 80s. And that's really good money for a woman with no college education during that time. You know, her kids, she had a nanny. The other women said that, you know, their kids went to private schools. Most of the women I interviewed had college-educated children, had owned their homes, bought new, and they drove newer cars. It was shocking. And I don't think it's just that they were making money hand over fist. I mean, they have regulars that they've been serving for decades who compensate them well and appreciate them in all different kinds of ways in addition to money. But there was also something that was really, I think, critical in terms of their ability to do the job because they had amazing experience that they could handle. They could turn over 15 tables several times within an hour, which is pretty impressive. And so just in sheer numbers, the younger waitresses weren't making the same kind of money. They weren't able to handle the load, the rush, as well as these women. So,
Candice, I wonder if we should actually listen to one of the, we've got a little bit of audio from your conversation with Wilma, who you were just talking about. It would be neat to air it so people can hear a little bit for themselves.
Yes, that's a great idea.
So I'm going to play this interview with Wilma Mobbs, and then we'll be back in just a couple minutes.
Okay.
Oh, it's great. Only 7 a.m. to 3, you don't find a job like that. That's all. They never open for dinner or anything. Food was good. Line sometimes out around the blocks, waiting to get in. You made fabulous money. I mean, there was times, many a times, when I'd make $800-$900 a week, when women in the highest profession was not making that. I was making more money than most people, most women, period, back in those days, 80s and 70s and times like that. Most people think this because they're waitresses and waiters, that they have no education, that they have no, couldn't do anything else and all that kind of stuff. And certainly in my case, I didn't have an education because, you know, college education or anything. And I did it, but the thing is, I could have gotten it if I'd wanted to work for it later on, but I happened to like it, so I stayed with it. You had to be good to work there, yeah. And he was very strict to work for. But he always told you and showed you everything he wanted done his way when you went in there. And he was very nice. If you did it, you know, a couple of three times, he'd say, okay. But when you kept doing it, you were dead meat. If you didn't, you know. But he was very strict and everything, but he was a good man. Al Boyajian. It seems like we started out with 6 tables, but we ended up, most of my career there was with 4 tables. That's all you had. He didn't care about how much help he had. He wanted a lot of help. It didn't matter to him. All he wanted you to do was turn those tables like that. And you could. With the way he had it fixed, you could. Got on the intercom and they'd say, 2, 3, 4's waiting, party of 5, party of 6. Oh, he had it down pat. He had it down pat. I didn't work on regular customers, but I did have some. And a lot of times, a lot of those regular customers will expect you to do something. One time, some guy out of the blue said to me, can't you at least slip me a half a grapefruit? I said, are you kidding? Are you kidding? Slip me a half a grapefruit. I'm gonna jeopardize my job to give you a half a grapefruit, cheap old crap. I didn't tell him that. Isn't that something? I had a fight. I had one on Saturday afternoon. I had a customer that sent the side of bacon back 3 times. And the cooks just kept giving it back to me, which I think was just about the same. I don't think they did anything. And so after the third time, I went to the boss. Well, if it had been the old man, bless him, dead and gone, but the son, as I told you, took over. And he, poor thing, didn't know what to do. I went to him. I said, look, I've had this back 3 times. This man sent his bacon back 3 times, and those cooks are doing nothing. Well, they got mad at me. He carried it over till the next day, Sunday morning. And I have a station full of people. 30 minutes have gone by, and I haven't received any orders. I go back to pick them up, and my order's not there, and go back. And I finally caught on. I said, what he's pissed about is because I took that bacon back. I said, I didn't take the bacon back because I wanted to. The customer sent it back, and this idiot should know that. So anyway, he went back there, and he didn't do anything about it. And I said, well, you know something? You might not be able to do anything about it, but I can. I'm out of here. He said, oh, Willie, you can't do that. You've been here too long. I said, watch me. I don't know whether the people got it from left or what, but I did.
Candace, are you still with us there?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Good. What does it feel like to hear an old interview of yours? Do you listen back to those frequently?
Oh, I haven't heard Wilma's recently, and it was amazing. She's, you know, one of my featured waitresses in San Francisco, and she had worked at Sears Fine Foods, which is an institution that's still there today, for a long time. And part of the reason why Wilma left was because, you know, Al Boyajian, who she was saying was her manager, who she loved, ended up basically dying, and he gave the business to his kids, and they just didn't have the same work ethic or knowledge of how to run a restaurant. And Sears did close temporarily until it was purchased by somebody else. But when it was repurchased, they hired all the old waitresses back because they understood how critical they were to their business. So it's wonderful to hear Wilma.
I will just for folks who just heard that was the beginning of that clip. Also was from American Public Media's Weekend America that was broadcast in 2004. I'm curious, Candace, because I know the project included oral histories with dozens of waitresses, also photographs, and you said that you had studied theorists and historians who write about sociology and gender and labor in restaurants, and you mentioned a couple times that you were in school when you began. I'm curious to hear you talk about some of your kind of like methodology and practice behind the project.
Well, you know, I was in graduate school while I was doing it. It was my thesis work for my visual criticism program at California College of the Arts in San Francisco. And so I studied a lot of Foucault and, I, you know, like you said, you know, spatial politics and power. And I was very clear that I knew that there was cultural criticism that would be a huge advantage to how I was going to access this material, but I also really wanted to focus on oral history because I thought, you know, if I had just relied on all those books and all those theorists, and there had been a few really seminal books written about waitressing, had I not gone out and actually done the oral history, I would have had a very different book, and I believe wouldn't have really reached the truth of what these women were experiencing, because even though I was waitressing, I was not having their experience. So it led me to all these different places throughout the country. I traveled about 26,000 miles, and I would make sure that ahead of time I would call either the Chambers of Commerce or the Visitors Bureaus, the places that I wanted to visit, and find the people who grew up in that area. And said, you know, what places do you remember from your childhood? What restaurants are still around? And what, you know, are the waitresses still there? And then they would lead me to those institutions, and I would talk to the management and say, you know, this is the parameters of this project. You know, do you have any waitresses you can recommend? And they would lead me to somebody, and then I would interview them on the phone very briefly to see if they were a good candidate, and then send out pre-questionnaires. And then actually take the trip. Ask them to gather any old photographs that I could scan while I was there. And so by the time I actually come out to do the trip, you know, we had done a considerable amount of groundwork, which I think helped tremendously in terms of me getting. They had a better idea of where I was going with the interviews, and then they knew also me being a waitress helped. Mm-hmm. I think a lot, because I wasn't just a, you know, academic coming to a. See what their lives were like, you know.
And I know that we talked a little bit about the project that you've been involved in, sounds like for a while, but that you're working on now, recording the stories of longtime beauticians and in beauty shops. Are you taking a similar sort of approach? Can you tell us about this project?
Sure. This project is, it's interesting because although, you know, I want to rely on some of the processes I used for counterculture, it really is such a different beast. And the reason why it came about, really, I've been sitting in beauty salons since I was probably in my late teens. And I'm an African-American woman, and I recognize that when I would sit in these salons, I never saw any people other than black women in these places. And I thought that's really strange, because I live in San Francisco at the time. And it's a very multicultural, diverse place. And I thought, why is it that, you know, there's never anybody else in here? And when white women would come into the salon, my hairdresser would turn them away. And I was kind of horrified because, you know, I thought, this is really not okay. But there was this, what I realized after being in that one salon for about 10 years and really studying the culture there, I thought, you know, she's protecting this space. And there's a culture that's been generated here, and it's largely due to hair texture. It's not necessarily race, but it ends up being disseminated in these ways according to where these little pockets of where people feel comfortable, and so then that's where they gather to get their hair done. And I was really interested in these community salons where not only hair was being done, but connections were being made, culture was being maintained in these places. With gentrification is happening in a neighborhood, I just think it's very interesting what's happening in the salon. So looking at beauty shop cultures, you know, I'm very interested in the hairdressers, and I will approach the material in a similar way as I did with counterculture in terms of really understanding the labor and what it means to be a hairdresser. And they also make a pretty comfortable living. They're entrepreneurs. There's something very specific about what they're doing that's really, I think, has been overlooked in the same way that waitressing has. So in that way, it will be similar. But other aspects that I'm looking at, you know, which in terms of culture, I think will just, you know, break open a whole new opportunity for discovery.
I think that's so interesting, the way these places are actually sort of set places for particular social groups and communities to gather, and they identify themselves with the place of business. And there's also such a strong bond that both with beauticians and with waitresses, between the customer, the client, and the service person, you know, the waitress or the beautician, where there's a lot of like brand loyalty. Like, you won't go to the diner that doesn't have your favorite waitress, or you won't go to the beautician who's your hairdresser, and you even feel guilty, like you're cheating on on your waitress or beautician if you go to somebody else.
Absolutely, and I think that's really well said, because for the most part, even if the food isn't good, or even if they don't do your hair the way you like it, you still go back, because it isn't just about the hair, it's really about all of these other things, and a lot of times it's your connection to the community. I know in the 50s and 60s, you know, during the civil rights movement, a lot of the black salons really had, they were almost these hot spots for political activity. So for people who didn't want their mail, like say they were an NAACP member or something, they didn't want their mail going to their houses, so they would have it sent to the beauty shop. And it was kind of a safe haven for you to be, you know, political or to have whatever belief systems that you felt were supported in your community. And so the senators and other elected officials would make sure that they were at the beauty salon campaigning, because they knew that's where the word was going to get out. You know, the beauty salon and the diners is where the word's going to get out. And so there are stories of, you know, a woman, a hairdresser, having somebody under the hairdryer while she's driving someone else down to the voting booth.
Wow.
You know, and so I would like to see if that's actually happening maybe in Latino salons in this country, maybe in Boyle Heights in Los Angeles.
Right.
Or anywhere, you know, how is this manifesting itself in other cultures? And, you know, I don't know if it is just that, you know, with African-American hair texture, because it is so different than a lot of other hair textures, it might be more concentrated. You know, I don't know. I did just receive a fellowship from the Library of Congress to find out. So that's what I'm doing, is the next year I'm going to beauty salons throughout the country and seeing what I discover.
It does seem, what's exciting to me is how much this project really honors both in the Waitress Project and also in about beauty shops, really honors these spaces as real cultural institutions and really honors the work as being real really important for us to understand who we are as a culture, which I think is so cool. And Candace, we just have a couple more minutes, but I wanted to make sure that you, because I know you're still looking for beauty shops to reach out to and to include in the project. If people listening have some thoughts for you, how can they reach you, and what kinds of stuff are you looking for?
Well, thank you. Yes, I will be actually taking my first trip to the New England, New York area in July, and I'm looking for salons that are kind of cultural hotbeds of activity, whether it's, you know, in a place that's been around for a long time, maybe at least, say, 15 to 20 years. And really, if you know of your friends or family anywhere in the country, please contact me and let me know if there are any interesting salons. I'm looking for all different subcultures, ethnic groups, immigrant populations, everything from transgender salons to, I might be getting into an Hasidic Jew wig salon in Brooklyn. So I'm really, you know, I really want a nice assortment. And you can reach me at www.tailormadeculture.com. That's my website. And my email address is candacy, C-A-N-D as in dog, A-C-Y, at TaylorMadeCulture.com.
People can also get in touch if they're listening with the radio station, and we can help you get in touch with Candace. I have a personal request also. I've been kind of obsessed with collecting the punny hair salon names. Just in our town right here, we've got a place called Hairy Situations and another called Main Street, spelled M-A-N-E.
Right.
And I've been kind of... and there's one more that now I'm forgetting. Oh, Hair We Are is another one. And I've been asking people about other punny hair salons that they know about. Someone just told me about one called American Hair Force and another called Snippity Crickets. And I'm totally obsessed. So if you could keep your ear out for us.
I will. And maybe we can just share notes throughout this project. I would love that. Because, the book will be out hopefully in the next couple of years. Once I finish a fellowship, I have another year to write the book. And, and I would like to, as much as it's about these women who are working in it, it is about these places as well, and their names and the signage and the way they look. So that's, yes, thank you so much. It's a really great idea.
Thank you for joining us. We're excited to learn more, to hear it and read it when it comes out.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been lovely.
Okay, talk to you soon.
All righty. Bye-bye.